Welcome back to the Bonhoeffer Podcast. I'm your host, Corey Tuttle, and today my guest is Dr. Michael Mawson. I think second time I've had someone have multiple interviews, so this will be fun. Dr. Mawson is the McLaurin Goodfellow Associate Professor of Theological and Religious Studies at the University of Auckland, New Zealand, and is the author of a new book entitled Standing Under the Cross, Essays on Bonhoeffer's Theology. Mike, thanks so much for coming back on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Corey. It's great to be back here.
Yeah, it's I can inform you that it's almost been a month now, and I feel like I'm just now getting over the jet lag from the visit down under to come see you guys.
I can't complain of jet lag, but it did take me at least a week to recover from the Bonhoeffer Congress, just in terms of catching up on sleep and relaxing my body.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was some endeavor. It's the first one I've been to. I wasn't able to make it to the 2021 in Stellenbosch, but for the listeners, in this past January in Sydney, Mike and Di Rayson, who's also been on the podcast, really put together a wonderful International Bonhoeffer Congress, which is every 4 years. Bonhoeffer scholars from around the world come together and have a Bonhoeffer camp, essentially. Is that?
Yeah, no, that describes it well.
Awesome. Yeah, it was the most rewarding experience I've had as a sort of PhD student, Bonhoeffer student, where I come together with like minds, that sort of thing. And it was, I told Phil this as well, it was the most well put on conference I've ever attended as well, as far as the ability to communicate. So well done. And I'm sure everyone would say the same. So well done on that.
Thank you. Yeah, that's right. And we had a team of organizers and others who were sort of helping with different aspects of it as well.
Before we get into the book, I figure we could reflect a little bit about that experience. You said obviously it took a lot out of you. It took a week to recover from. What was that experience like? Planning it. What did you really enjoy from it? Any takeaways, that sort of thing? I would love to hear just kind of your experience overall.
Let me say a few things, Corey, and then just interrupt if you've got questions or sure. If there's anything you want to pick up on. So we started planning it in 2020. So really, wow. A number of years beforehand. So it was a lot of sort of early work and planning, thinking about a theme, thinking about some of the kinds of people we wanted to invite as plenary speakers, and then eventually putting out the call for papers and inviting and hosting everyone down in Sydney. So with the Congress, we wanted to include all kinds of Bonhoeffer scholarship. So the different ways that people are engaging with, drawing on, pressing back against Bonhoeffer. But we especially sort of highlighted the theme of crisis and hope. So how Bonhoeffer can be a conversation partner in relation to some of the contemporary crises that are engulfing us, whether it's climate change, racial justice, the rise of new forms of authoritarianism, and so forth. So we sort of highlighted a number of these issues and, tried to have a conversation that had Bonhoeffer in the middle of it, but also, looked at what's going on in our world today and looked at how we can begin to find resources to continue the struggle or push back a little. In terms of the Congress, so part of why it was an amazing experience for me and the other organisers was just bringing together some different worlds. So, interest in Bonhoeffer and conversations that have tended to be centred a bit more in the US and Europe, but then pressing into our place and some of the kinds of voices and theologians who have been influential for us. So people like Ann Patel Gray, and other local voices who are present as well. Thinking how some of these different conversations can learn from one another and contribute to theology and theological thinking.
That was precisely my experience. I think when it comes to sort of contextual theologies, just being a white guy from America that is studying in Scotland, like the kinds of thinking I encounter on a regular basis, and the kind of pushback amongst the scholars that I regularly encounter are majority US or Western based issues. So being there in the Congress was just wonderful because there's so much to First Nations people, Indigenous people that I haven't been exposed to, mainly because it's just where I'm from, like those issues don't reach as far to the States as, say, race issues and with African Americans, that sort of thing, in my context that I'm from. So it was just wonderful to be kind of exposed to all of this and see the ways that these are kind of worked out. I thought that was, that was a huge takeaway for me.
And also bringing some of the work from this end of the world into conversation with the rich Bonhoeffer scholarship that's taking place in other places, and bringing questions of colonization into dialogue with some of the work that's been done on Bonhoeffer and race and so forth as well. So just trying to think how those different conversations can learn from one another a little.
Yeah, and I
And there's
think,
always risk as well. So we invite people, we put them in a room, but we're never quite sure how it's going to work out. So
right. They seem to get
we
along
crack
pretty
on with
well.
it.
As far as I can recall, I think everyone got along pretty well. I also want to say that I think one of the benefits of having it there, obviously it limits some of the people who can travel to there, but majority of the time it's the other way around. There are so many people from that section of the world that just don't make it to the Bonhoeffer conversations because it's a long, long way. It's a lot of money, and there's just a rich collective of scholars that aren't able to be part of that conversation. So yeah, that was a huge feature of it.
And it was a difficult decision, but we really did press for people to come in person. So we didn't allow people to present their papers online, for instance, and we did have a Zoom option for streaming, but it was limited. And that was difficult because there's a carbon cost, it's expensive, but our gamble was having people together in the same space for 4 days would generate a different kind of energy than what we would have got if it had been a hybrid conference or more online. So some of that was very intentional as well.
And do you have any I guess papers or plenaries that kind of stick out to you as like
Yeah,
highlights?
the I
Not
it's
to the
difficult to sort
exclusion
of
of
single
others, but I
out.
guess, but like
Yeah.
are there any that really left you thinking for the next, week or two as you reflected on your time planning this,
So,
let's say?
there was one. This is just picking something somewhat randomly, but there was one session I went to. There was James. I might mispronounce his name, but James Tanaiti from India, who was looking at sort of Bonhoeffer reception there, and then a paper by Apaneru from Samoa, who was looking at Bonhoeffer and Kerikeri, and then Peter Klein did a sort of video essay. And part of what struck me about that session was just how creative it was. So how these three presenters were talking about very different contexts and ways that were concrete and local, and drawing Bonhoeffer in some very different ways. So I think one of the joys of the conference was just the constant surprises. So just popping into a session or listening to a paper and just hearing something new or hearing someone sort of think about Bonhoeffer in a way that I wouldn't have expected or wouldn't have anticipated. I also think the six plenaries were excellent. So just in terms of, again, a breadth of different kinds of approaches and different kinds of questions and issues and some of the conversations that those generated afterwards as well. I should also say, Corey, I came along to the post-grad event that you and some others were at before the Congress, and that really inspired me. So just the richness of some of the new work that's coming through and the new kinds of ways that people are thinking about Bonhoeffer and drawing on Bonhoeffer. Just the chance to sort of have long conversations about people's projects and what they're working on.
You're very kind and humble to not say that you also led that publishing workshop there. That I'll say that I did afterwards. I called my wife and said that was worth the price of the trip. As far as like I
Thank
was, it
you.
was just so the ability to have a Bonhoeffer scholar in the room and be like, all right, let's just like straightforward questions. No one else is in this room. How do I do this? And the benefit of that was even publishing in journals, that sort of thing, that was just so abstract. Instead of like a, this is the way to go about it, these are the kinds of things that you want to be looking for, it was really useful. But I want to say my main takeaways from the Congress. I really loved Amy Erickson's paper on church discipline, because it I thought it was just like such a it's a very intense Bonhoeffer text, because it's in discipleship. And I thought that the way that she navigated that, and kind of the, it was kind of a gear shift from the room, from previous papers. And so it was cool just to see the variety in the room beforehand, but then also to see, like, I got to know Amy pretty well while we were there. And to see that she's like, oh, I'm not a Bonhoeffer scholar. I did my, you know, she worked with Brian Brock up here, so we had a bunch of like a Aberdeen connection. But just for her to be like, yeah, I'm not a Bonhoeffer scholar, I just read this. And I told her that, like, the way that she just sort of like exegeted the text, like, here's what it says, we're going line by line, was just really like, oh man, this is such like a something that I wouldn't have thought about to kind of break down into very basic terms. But also, like, on that note, I think the big takeaway for me is, I think being, I mean, you probably have had this experience as well. When you're a PhD student, it can be an incredibly isolating experience. And I think also, I think that's true probably everywhere, but it's probably less true in Aberdeen, because the community, you know, we all rave about how great it is here. But still, I think there's probably two people that two students here on campus that are doing Bonhoeffer besides me. They're doing vastly different projects than me, like, not even close. Sorry. Like, only with the name Bonhoeffer is there any relation. And we almost never overlap in our various circles, because one's doing theological ethics and we'll go to different seminars, that sort of thing. I'm sure you know what I mean by this. I've gone to plenty of conferences and gone into the room and been like, okay, who are my people? You know, and you're kind of looking around. You have that experience just in seminars where, like, okay, we're going to talk about Augustine today. And I'm like, okay, I'm just going to sit and listen and take notes, because, you know, like, I could tell you a tiny bit, but not much more. I haven't read a ton of this, but this is the first kind of experience that I've had where I go into a room and it's like, okay, we're all reading the same thing. We're all have similar questions. Like, many of us have similar questions. And there was just sort of a, I always say that when I went to SST one time, for the listener, it's for the Society for the Study of Theology. It's a yearly conference that takes place in Coventry, England. I presented a paper there, and, like, it was my first year doing a PhD. I walk in, I don't know anyone. I'm kind of that nervous student. It's like, who are my friends? I don't like, I'll just walk around and try to socialize and die inside as I try to make friends. But the cool thing is that after you give your first paper, you have friends. Like, immediately you're like, the people who have come to read this, to listen and have asked questions afterwards, from here on out, I know kind of who my people are in the room. But this is such a cool experience, because you go there and you're like, okay, it's everyone. Like, I can kind of bounce around, and, like, you know, I'm there for 5 days. I'm like, there are the amount of people I have to check off my list to say that okay, I finally met you in person. It's just like, it was crazy. So I was impressed by the amount of collegiality and friendliness that everyone had. But it was, I came back just really encouraged, thinking that, like, okay, I might only be studying a lot about this one person, but in these sorts of rooms, I can kind of navigate. Whereas, you know, being a PhD student and surrounded by other theological students that are focusing on other figures, you're like, please, someone ask me about Bonhoeffer so that I can contribute to this conversation.
No, and yeah, part of the value of it is certainly building a bit of solidarity or meeting other people who work on Bonhoeffer or at least have some kind of interest. I'd also think a lot both in Bonhoeffer spaces, but also in other spaces, just about kindness. So how to set up spaces and conversations which aren't competitive and where people are learning from one another without feeling anxious about who they are and what they've got to contribute. So I think about a lot of that with, the seminars I run. Some of this I learned from Aberdeen as well. And I think a little of that probably came through in the Congress. So, as organizers, we thought about, well, let's have an opening reception with lots of food, again, as a way of just sort of building a bit of a social space. Let's make sure we have long morning and afternoon tea breaks and a good lunch break, again, because those conversations over the break and the breaks are almost as important as the papers themselves, and are a chance to sort of meet with other authors to follow up on issues that have come up in the sort of papers and lectures and those sorts of things. So it's
Did you have anyone that you were looking forward to meeting that you hadn't met in person yet?
there were a number of people. I'm trying to think. So Christopher Norris, who wrote a book called Witnessing Whiteness that I read a couple of years ago, and just so it's a book on sort of Stanley Horowitz, James Cone, and Bonhoeffer. But it's an excellent book, and I just loved reading it. It's one of those books I've read a couple of times. So the chance to meet with him briefly, I didn't have as much time with him as I would have liked to. I'm trying to think. I'm sure there were a number of others like that as well, where I've read people's work, but never had a chance to sort of meet them in person.
For me, it was, I mean, I don't think I've met basically anyone other than Andrew Clark Howard in person. But as far as even like Zoom, I've met quite a pe few people doing these interviews. Well, one person I really wanted to meet was Cliff Green, and that was so cool. I mean, I love his book. I love, he has so many great stories, and so I got a picture with him, walked up, and of course he
No, it's
dismissed it.
wonderful that Cliff and Keith Clements could come. So some of that earlier generation of Bonhoeffer scholars and still have a lot to contribute in terms of some of the things they're thinking about.
When I met Clifford Green, he said, we've emailed back and forth about having him come on sometime, and it's just kind of fallen off the shelf or the desk at some point, which is fine. And he was like, "Oh, I think I remember you. Yeah, we should have a conversation sometime." And I was like, "Cliff, I will drop anything anytime to do this." And he said, "Perhaps you would like to hear about my time with Maria von Wedemeyer." And I was like, "Yes, Cliff, that would be perfect. I'm sure every person listening to this podcast would love to just have." He was like, "She was my neighbor for a long time." I was like, "I want to hear absolutely everything that you can tell me." So that was it was like a highlight for me. It was really cool.
Cliff would have some great stories, and he's part of that generation who went over to Germany to look at manuscripts in Eberhard Becker's office and before a lot was translated as well. So
That's so cool.
well worth trying to capture some of that.
Yeah, definitely. Well, let's get into this book. I feel like half the interview is going to be the Congress, but it was just such a fun time. That's like I wanted to unpack it with you. This book, Standing Under the Cross, is a collection of essays. How did this come together, I guess? I mean, it seems like a wide-ranging topics written over a few years. How did you decide which ones to put in? All of that. Like, what made you think we should make this into a book?
So the essays were written over a period of about 10 years. Most of them have been revised, or I've done more work turning them into the book chapters. I'd been thinking about this for a while. So some of them actually hadn't been published, I should say that. So not I think there's 12 chapters. Maybe three of them hadn't been sort of published previously. So they're conference papers or presentations that I'd done that I never got around to sort of to writing up and expanding. I think I'd initially started with a list of about 16 or 17. Actually, maybe even more than that. So I'd started with a
Wow.
longer list and gone back and started reading some of them. Some of them I just decided, weren't worth sort of preserving, or I wasn't quite happy with the arguments. Interestingly, I couldn't have predicted that. So some of the essays I loved writing at the time and was very happy with at the time, looking back now, I'm just not so sure about them. And other essays where, it's or one or two journal articles, I'd submitted them, never looked at them again, and went back and actually found I was more happy with them than I'd thought. Trying to gather up some thinking over a number of years, and organizing it around sort of themes of hermeneutics, the body, and theology of the cross, or a community of the cross. So it does have a kind of consistency that runs through a lot of the material as well.
Yeah, definitely. It makes me think of your workshop about publishing, just the differing opinions you have when you look at your past writings, and how I was so encouraged by that, because you're sitting there like, I have to get it perfect, I have to. And so to have you look back on it and say, oh yeah, even for this book, I went back and was like, I don't agree with that anymore, or oh man, I could have said that way better, or like, I didn't think this was the best thing at the time, but this is actually my favorite bit that I have. Was like, oh, this is a normal thing to experience when you're writing books. Okay, or theses, I guess, which is cool. Awesome. So one thing I wanted to ask you, as you said, it was written over a period of 10 years. I guess 8 of those probably you were here in Aberdeen as a professor. I wanted to ask, over 10 years is a long time. I guess the question is, last time I interviewed you, we talked about the book form of your dissertation. How has your thinking from that book changed to this book? Because it seems like a big gap of time. I'm sure there's lots of development and lots of increasing focus.
So I'm the way I work is very relational. So I'm often influenced by the people around me or the conversations that I'm in. But in saying that, I think there is also a fair amount of consistency. So, perhaps when I'm at Aberdeen, there's some kinds of sort of work and systematics and ethics going on there, and I'm contributing to those conversations. When I moved down to Australia, there's other kinds of pressures and contextual concerns in that place that I'm responding to. And I spend the introduction of the book sort of just laying out a little bit of that narrative and some of the different contexts I've worked in and the ways that they've led me to read and think about Bonhoeffer a little differently. But I do think there's also a fair degree of consistency that runs through that. And, even if I go back and look at Christ Existing as Community, like that's a book that I'd still agree with and stand by, even though I perhaps wouldn't write a book like that anymore, simply because my conversations and interests have sort of shifted to some other issues. I don't know, does that capture it?
Yeah, that's great. You mentioned your introduction. I was wondering if we could get into that a bit, because it
Of
sort of
course.
sets that how the differing contexts that you've been in have informed kind of your thought. It was really interesting to see your description of Aberdeen in the book, just to think like you're like, oh, all the conversations in the Bobbin. I'm like, oh yeah, that's the pub that I go to after systematic seminars. Like, small world, But yeah, let's talk a bit about this introduction. What sticks out to you is kind of the gist of what you're trying to get across with this work.
Yeah, I think the main purpose of the introduction was to sort of try and provide a bit of the narrative that, or give some context to the different essays and the different kinds of things that I do in the book. And the way I chose to do that was just, through a little biography. So hopefully in ways that are interesting, but just talking about the different contexts that I've learned from. So Notre Dame, where I did my PhD, Aberdeen, where I had my first job, and I was based for about 7 years, and then Australia, which is where I sort of finished off the book, and I actually did the sort of final parts of it in the summer, just as I was moving across here to New Zealand. So it's sort of laying out, some of the different people who influenced me in those different spaces, teachers, colleagues, students, and some of the ways in which work I was doing, whether it was on disability theology, whether it was on divine possibility, like different ways that those sort of contexts were generating those questions. So that's really what the introduction's trying to do, is just how have I what are the things that have formed me and sort of made me read Bonhoeffer in the ways that I do?
Awesome. You mentioned the disability theology. Obviously, we have a really rich discussion here in Aberdeen with Brian Brock. Yeah, I mean, just the theological ethics department here in Aberdeen is amazing. And I know for a fact that Daniel Rempel, who will probably be listening to this, was like very excited about you to come on to just talk about disability theology, because that's what he did his on BART and disability theology. So you have this chapter on disability theology. I'm wondering if you could talk me through it. What are some of the things that you really wanted to get across in that chapter?
Yeah, so the chapter's called Creatures Coram Deo, Bonhoeffer, Disability and Theological Anthropology. And a lot of it is engaging with questions of personhood, and in particular, appreciatively critiquing the work of Hans Reinders, who's a very prominent disability theologian. And it's trying to sort of think through a kind of social Trinitarianism that Reinders and some other disability theologians adopt, and what some of the limitations of that move might be. So specifically, there's a kind of a patristic move that Reinders is making, where he's sort of seeing persons as drawn into the life of the Trinity. And if that's useful and interesting per se, sometimes he lays it out in ways that downplay bodily limits or downplay our connection to the earth. So again, as a sort of appreciative critique, I bring Bonhoeffer into that conversation and try and suggest how Bonhoeffer might have some different language around personhood, or some different language around what it means to be human, that isn't so much sort of pressing us upwards, but also helping us to sort of attend to the complexity and the messiness on the ground. That's a very sort of broad overview of the essay, but
No,
it's
that's
sort of
great.
trying to. So it was at a stage where I was sort of reading and thinking a lot about disability theology, and just trying to see what was sort of valuable in some of the work that was being done, but also just add my own piece into that, I guess.
How does Bonhoeffer's view of personhood and what it means to be human relate to disability theology? Like, how what resources, you mentioned that you use that to engage, but what resources do you think he gives that might be not in
Yeah,
the
so
other figures?
the main language I sort of use in that essay comes from creation and fall, and the ways in which we're limited by others, or limited in our encounters with others. We're only persons relationally. We're never, just self-enclosed individuals. And on that point, both Bonhoeffer and people like Reinders would be in agreement. But I think Bonhoeffer just gives a little bit more specificity on sort of how others limit us, and how those sort of limits can be both a place of God's presence, but also a place of pain and difficulty. So he gives us, perhaps a few more resources for thinking about the difficulties of friendships, including sort of friendships with persons with disabilities. Yeah, again, I sort of laid that out pretty carefully over a number of pages, but that's some of what I think he gives us. So the anthropology that comes through, especially in places like Creation and Fall.
That's great. You mentioned also divine passibility. You have a chapter here on divine passibility and Moltmann. This is something that I've been thinking about a lot, so I just was very excited once I read. Am I right in saying that there seems to be sort of two ways of interpreting Bonhoeffer and Luther, I guess. It seems to be like, these are caricatures, by the way. There's the like, Bonhoeffer is basically Bart, and Bonhoeffer is basically Luther. Like, at his core, the thing that he would align himself with most is Bart or Luther. And These so you could define the Luther camp as people who had written on Bonhoeffer and Luther, Michael DeYoung, Justa Kaiser, Caitlin Barker. They've all been on the podcast as well. And then you would have the Andreas Pangritz, Edward Van Slot, maybe Christiana Tietz, as sort of the Bonhoeffer is much closer to Barth. What is your take on that? Sort of that sort of caricature that I've just drawn.
Yeah, I feel like you're trying to put me in a box here, Corey. I'm going to forget the date of it, but Michael de Jong's book, Bonhoeffer's Reception of Luther, is a really excellent argument for Bonhoeffer's Lutheranism. Perhaps iron against some of the ways that he's tended to be read as very close to Barth. And I'd broadly agree with Michael, and I've got a chapter that's sort of looking at his book and sort of reading it pretty closely. But I would also want to sort of break open what it means for sort of Bonhoeffer to be a Lutheran a bit, and perhaps sort of see that in ways that are a bit more fluid and in ways that are also sort of allowing him to incorporate all sorts of sort of modern influences and all sorts of other influences that don't fit within a sort of set Lutheran framework or tradition. I don't do a whole lot on that directly, but that's sort of what I'm trying to signal in some ways is there's a kind of expansiveness to Bonhoeffer's style and thinking that draws in all sorts of influences. And for us as readers, it means we also don't need to sort of interpret Bonhoeffer as having one sort of univocal set meaning to what he's doing. Often it can be sort of drawn on constructively or used in ways that are there in the text, but perhaps not always the sort of primary motivation that's driving them.
The chapter on divine passibility in Moltmann,
Yeah.
do you think the Lutheranism at all plays into that?
Yeah, I think so.
In
Like a number of
Luther
chapters have
thinkers,
a
I
bit of
should
a
say.
structure where I'm sort of reading Bonhoeffer in conversation with someone else. And those aren't just sort of arbitrary dialogues. So they're sort of trying to sort of press into the detail of what Bonhoeffer's doing and set up conversations that show us something about his thinking and something about what his thinking can do. In the chapter you're referring to, Only the Suffering God Can Help, which is a quote from Bonhoeffer's Prison Theology, Bonhoeffer and Eugen Moltmann on divine passibility or divine suffering. So what I try and do there is look at Moltmann's theology of the cross and the crucified God, and then look at ways in which that's both similar and different to some of Bonhoeffer's more sort of fragmentary or inchoate sort of thinking that comes through, especially in the prison theology. And the argument I'm trying to make is that Moltmann is sort of systematizing and clarifying some things that remain a little messier and a little more open-ended for Bonhoeffer and also for Luther, I think, as well. So, Moltmann's explicitly trying to sort of resolve some contradictions that he sees in Luther's theology of the cross by giving it a Trinitarian framework. So, by looking at the roles of the Father, Son, and the Spirit in the event of the cross. And Moltmann thinks that that can sort of avoid some of these sort of contradictions that just run through Luther's ways of talking about the cross. I guess my argument is in that chapter is that Bonhoeffer is not he's not sort of trying to he's talking about sort of suffering God language in ways that have all sorts of contradictions, but he's not trying to sort of provide a metaphysical description of God or a sort of systematic theology. He's trying much more to sort of think about who is this God who encounters us, or who are we in relation to God, I guess? And language of the suffering God plays a role there in that sort of relational sense that is different to the more sort of systematic or metaphysical sense that sort of Moltmann's setting out. And that means that he can get away with some things that or at least he can do. He's engaged in a different kind of project than what Moltmann is, and often we sort of conflate the two or sort of see them as very similar because they do sound similar in lots of ways. So it's just trying to trying to separate them out and perhaps provide a little bit of a case for why I think Bonhoeffer's more relational or existential language might have some value. Sorry, Corey, that was a very long answer to a
No,
simple
that's
question.
wonderful. 'Cause that my thinking has been, so this last year, I sat in on a master's level class, because my supervisor, Phil Ziegler, was teaching on, it was a Christology class, but I can't, it was on Christology, but I can't think of the official title of the course. But we read, Bruce McCormick's new work, the, Humility of the Eternal Son. So when, obviously, that's on my mind when I'm reading things like divine passibility, a chapter on divine passibility, and sort of seeing like, and seeing the Lutheran Barthian sort of conversation, and then thinking, okay, how does this, is there a way to have Bonhoeffer speak to this conversation? So that's just kind of questions I've been thinking, pondering quite a bit. Anything offhand that you do you think there's any real relationship there?
Yeah, look, I haven't, up to my shame, I haven't read the McCormick book. So I've got a copy of it on my shelf, but I just haven't worked through it
No
in
worries.
detail. So I probably shouldn't get myself into trouble by saying too much there.
Oh, you're good. Yeah, I'm more just I've applied for a conference and to pose a paper for it, and more just wondering a little bit of and some more help for my homework. And but you've already given me plenty before this even started. I want to also ask you about the this James this chapter on Bonhoeffer and James Cone. You mentioned that sort of the move from Notre Dame to Aberdeen to Sydney to New Zealand, there was increase it seems like there's increasingly engage more engagement with contextual theologies. Is that would that be fair? You think?
I think that's probably fair. Again, like I'd want to complicate language of contextual theology a little bit, but
What do you think is the correct way to talk about this? Because obviously, to say contextual theology, every theology is contextual. We might, yeah. What do you think is the most
like I
helpful?
think like my shift would be to sort of recognizing just how much rich work is going on close to the ground here. In ways that perhaps don't always get a lot of attention in the north. So just learning from and engaging with what scholars in this sort of region are doing, and the global south more broadly as well.
Awesome. Thanks. So this chapter on the stumbling block in the lynching tree, reading Bonhoeffer's lectures on Christology with James Cone. How do these lectures of the Christology relate to James Cone?
So this was actually an AAR paper I gave in maybe 2019 or 2020, actually maybe even more recently than that. And it was part just thinking about that context and looking for a chance to spend a bit more time reading and thinking about James Cone, who's a theologian I've always enjoyed, but just never had a chance to sort of systematically work through some of his books. Also, sort of recognizing that Cone himself made a number of very positive comments about Bonhoeffer, and just wanting to sort of think about that a little more. So, how Bonhoeffer might be present in some of his work and some of his ways of doing Christology. So, the chapter's a little bit of a comparative piece, looking specifically around some of the critiques of Docetism and their sort of attempts to sort of think about Christology in ways that are very concrete and attending to the concrete person of Jesus. There's also a little bit of a critique of Bonhoeffer that goes on in that chapter. So I track through some of the moves in Bonhoeffer's Christology lectures, and I suggest there's a point in which he could have chosen to be even more concrete in his sort of thinking about, who Christ is and what reconciliation means. But instead, he sort of moves to more abstract language of sin and salvation at a sort of very broad level. And Cone's ways of thinking about, Jesus in the midst of empire, gives us something that can sort of supplement Bonhoeffer or press him. helps extend some of the direction that I think he's going.
That's excellent. Thank you. Thank you. I won't keep you for too much longer, but I really appreciate these little shorter overviews of these chapters, and I think the listeners will really enjoy it as well. For those who don't know, obviously these books can be pretty pricey when they first come out, but you can get them usually ordered at a university library. That is the easiest way to get access to all of these, especially this T.T. Clark series. I've seen it just in university libraries that I've visited. That's just an option for the listener if they're looking to read
Corey,
more.
I'll say a couple of things about the T.N.T. Clark series. So this is a
Sure.
series that I edit with Jenny McBride and Phil Ziegler. I think I actually should have checked, but I think we've got about 10 books that are under the series at the moment and a couple more which are coming out shortly. They are expensive. They all go to paperback, so I think they stay on hardback for a year, maybe a year and a half, and then automatically switch over to paperback. So for those hardback copies, you may want to have your library order them, but they do become a whole lot cheaper at some point down the track. And it is a series as well that we're always interested in sort of having people approach us with with projects or proposals, approaching either Jenny, Phil, or myself. And that's just been a joy to work on in terms of learning from some of the different kinds of work that people are doing. Dissertations, senior scholars, and we've recently started to have a couple of edited collections in the series as well.
Awesome. And for those that have books coming out in that series, get in touch. Let's chat about them. I would love to read them, and I've read quite a few of them actually. It was fun to be at the Congress and see sort of the new ones that are coming out and being like, all right, that's on the list. Want to talk about that? Want to chat with that person? So there's lots of good stuff coming from that series. Yeah, lots to look forward to. I wanted to ask you, so we usually do the desert island question, but it's your
Oh,
second
great.
time on, so you've already done that one. So I'll just say, instead of that, we'll just do two book recommendations that are from the Global South that you think people should read. So we can start exposing people to this rich collection of scholars.
Look, so at the risk of self-promotion, I've just had a book that was published last week called Unsettling Theologies, Memory, Identity, and Place. Sorry, this is a book that I've co-edited with Brian Collier, who's an Old Testament scholar based at Malawa Theological Seminary in Samoa. And what we tried to do with this collection was bring Indigenous, so Aboriginal, Māori, Pacifica, Tongan, Tuvalu, Samoan, and white scholars from this part of the world into and collect up some of the sort of creative work that's going on, and perhaps with a particular view of what it means to do theology in the wake of colonization or out of a recognition of some of the damage that Christianity has done in this part of the world. So most of the sort of authors in that volume have also got their own books, which are excellent and well worth checking out. But that book I think is 13 essays and just I think showcases some of the kinds of work that are going on around here.
I will say that's the best part about, I mean, it's nice to be able to get in touch with you quickly via Facebook, but the best part of being your Facebook friend is seeing these chapter summaries that you've been putting out. For those for the listener, Mike's been putting out like chapter summaries that are kind of short summaries, like he just spoke about his own chapters of this upcoming book. That have just been wonderful. Just to like, I'm looking forward to them every day now. I'm like, all right, what am I going to learn today when I hop on Facebook? Which is not usually the vibe that Facebook gives. So I appreciate the change in my timeline.
And again, just as a way of for me, it's a way of just sort of engaging with editing the books or co-editing the books, a way of engaging with the work of some of the people who have been influencing me and helping me to sort of think about things a little differently.
One other book.
Oh, one other book. So this is I'm a little bit on the spot here, Corey, but I'm
You're
just
good.
thinking of a book I read last year, who is by it's by Satya Nathan Clarke, or Satya Clarke, who now works at the United Theological College, where I used to work in Australia. And this is his first book. So he's got a number, and a number of excellent books, but the one that really was something new and unexpected for me. It's called Dalits and Christianity, Subaltern Religion and Liberation. This is Sati's work a number of years ago with Dalit communities in India, and then trying to sort of draw out our concrete theological reflections from that context. So off the, again, just one of those books that I just read and was thinking about for a long time afterwards, and something that's very different from the kinds of work that I do. But just, I think, it introduced me to some new kinds of conversations in a part of the world that I haven't had a lot to do with.
I'm always looking for book recommendations. Not that I don't have enough to read as a doctoral student already, but that's what this is about.
Yeah,
Awesome.
no, there becomes a point where you just have to stop reading and just get it done. But I'm not your supervisor, Corey, so I'm not going to tell you
Something tells me my supervisor might agree with your advice. Actually,
that.
that's this year, and that's why I'm able to kind of start doing podcasts again. So much of my first, these past 2 years have just been head down in books that often aren't that are either primary text Bonhoeffer or just other seminar related stuff that isn't Bonhoeffer related at all. It ends up being like, well, I haven't read a secondary source in quite a while. I've been reading on Barthes or Moltmann or something like that, where you know the deal. So now this whole year is just writing. That's the game, is hopefully by the end of this year to have a draft. So that gives me a lot more time to kind of have these conversations and to dip my toe back into the secondary scholarship and have fun conversations and get together again. So this is fun.
Yeah, thanks, Corey. This has been great.
Awesome. So again, for the listener, the book is Standing Under the Cross: Essays on Bonhoeffer's Theology from T.N.T. Clark by Michael Mawson. Thanks again, Mike. This is great.
Thanks, Corey. Take care.